Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loader join us for our two-part special on Glastonbury Abbey's sphere of influence. This is part two. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show. And we start with just the end of last week's show from part one of Glastonbury Abbey's Sphere of Influence.
Every kind of lord in England or high status landowner has an obligation to the king in terms of some form of service. Now, that service will either be administrative or it will be military. And this is where Mark mentioned the idea of knight's fees. Some of the land, we talked about devolving power and land. A knight's fee is usually a land grant given to a lord or a knight, usually a local.
So we usually use the word fee to talk about money, don't we? Yeah, but this is land.
This is land. So what you're doing is you're giving a parcel of land to a retainer, basically, who might be a knight, one of the knightly classes. And what they will do is they will administer that parcel of land for you. And in return, for them taking the revenues and rents from that land, they will provide you with a certain number of days a year of military service. And of course, these people, knights as they were, are having to, from that land, pay for horses, pay for armoured harnesses, their armour, they're paying for their weaponry, but they're also paying for men-at-arms or common soldiery to come with them. So they would have their own group of little retainers they've portioned off their land to. So the idea that you get this system of a quite effective system of military ranking, in a sense, where if you need an army, the abbot can send out the word to all of his knights, arguably on the estates, or men with obligation on the estates, and suddenly he can raise an army of several hundred men within 24 hours who are obliged through the contract of their landholdings to come and support him. So it's that idea of kind of having an army. And it is very unusual, I know, your original question of having a monastery with a standing army, but you have to remember this isn't anything unusual. You've got to think of the massive armies of the Papal States in Rome, for example, and this idea that at the time, although it might fly in the face of what modern people's sensibility about Christianity and religion are, at the time this is part and parcel of the control of the church, you know, the control of land, and what they thought the furtherment of the church's aims and ambitions. Okay, so we're now standing inside a replica of an Anglo-Saxon hall, and this very much would have been a high-status dwelling, dating from anywhere from the 8th century, even 7th century, right through till the 11th century here. And this very much would have been the type of building we'd see on site at Glastonbury Abbey, and also on the sites of these manors we've been talking about, these high-status buildings.
So, yeah, because we've been talking quite a lot about buildings which have replaced the buildings that were there whilst the Abbey was thriving, and, you know, even before the Norman invasion in Anglo-Saxon times, but this is how it actually used to be. Now, there's also a Roman building next door. This is part of a little, I suppose, a kind of open-air museum type thing that they're building. Where are we exactly?
We're down at the Avalon Marshes Centre, and these are buildings built as part of kind of a bit of an experimental archaeology project to figure out the building techniques and also show people how buildings used to look in the past.
So there's no door here.
No. I think the door's yet to be fitted.
Okay. There is a door on the other side. Okay.
But you can see this idea of the high status work, this beautiful carved panel work. There's stained glass windows in the window frames, coloured glass being exceptionally expensive, of course.
Is there any evidence the Anglo-Saxons had coloured glass?
Absolutely. We've got coloured glass evidence at the Abbey, at Glastonbury Abbey. There were actually glass kilns at the Abbey they were using to, they're actually working with coloured glass at the Abbey. We also have evidence from Cheddar, where there's royal palaces in the Saxon period. We find archaeologically window glass there that was coloured, which belonged to these palace buildings, and that's actually what this building is based off, the idea of one of these buildings.
But it is all timber framed, it's all wood, it's I suppose that's some sort of cob infill or something.
It's wattle and daub, so it'll be a willow or withy fencing covered in a sort of daub, a plasterwork, mud and dung plaster.
So it's not surprising they haven't lasted 1,500 years.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, these buildings will last a fair while if they're upkept well, but of course they can be quite susceptible to fire or eventual degradation and damage.
We've got a fire right actually in the middle of the hall here. Is that, do you think, normal? Is that the sort of thing that we'd do? I mean, surely if you can have a hall, you want it to use as a space, not to put a fire in the middle.
Well, you do, but you've got to remember the hearth is the centre of your existence, your home, your well-being. It offers you warmth, it offers you safety in terms of keeping animals away.
If you put it next to the wall, you've got the possibility of a fire. Yeah.
So having it to slap bang in the centre of the floor, often you see the floor is a dirt floor around you, so there's not much to catch fire around you. It's either sunken in the floor or placed in a raised firebox, as it is here, and the smoke will go directly up and either exit through the rafters, exit through the thatch, or exit through particular special flues or vent holes in the roof.
Now, you talk about this as a hall, but was it actually someone's home? Would they live in a hall?
Yeah, absolutely. So you'd usually have a hall partitioned up into several areas. So you'd have kind of you'd have a communal area that we're standing in at the moment, so where people can feast and live and cook. That area, you'd often have a dais at the top. You see up there, which in the high status building is where, if you've got an important person, that's their domain up there, they can sit, they can lord it over the people.
Oh, it's slightly higher, actually, I noticed.
Raised. So it's that idea of status, you're raising yourself up. And often you have private rooms at the back, and we can see we've got private rooms about these are sleeping areas.
And would there be two stories here? Because it's big enough for that, isn't it? It's high enough.
Yeah, some buildings would have separate platforms in the rafters that would add extra sleeping space, storage space. Very common to, of course, store food higher up, away from rodents and vermin. Down below. So often you have storage racks up above, sometimes, like I said, sleeping areas. Quite often these were multiple person dwellings, so you'd have a whole family living in one of these buildings. You might have a private room for the higher status or the heads of the household and their spouses and spouse. And then you'd have the communal area. Quite often people either sleep around the walls or on the floor in these areas here as well.
And so during the daytime, what would the people who lived in here be up to?
Well, the people who lived in here, if this is a high-status building, they'd probably be involved in the administration or controlling the land around them.
Telling everyone else what to do.
But yeah. If it was a more common dwelling, a smaller hall, a smaller building, of course, they'd be agricultural farm labourers or livestock controllers.
Just one thing, I mean, here at Shapwick, they've got runes everywhere. Now, this most of us have seen through The Lord of the Rings, that sort of thing. Was it actually, were they used in Anglo-Saxon times?
Yeah, absolutely. The Anglo-Saxon runes, of course, they're from Germanic origin, the Saxons culture coming over from Germany, or Germany, southern Denmark, that kind of area. And we do find runes used as a form of writing. And what happens is the Latin language that comes over from Europe replaces runes. But the runes have a full alphabet. They've got often symbolic meaning as well as literal meaning, and it's very much tied up into the magic and folklore of the area at the time, as well as
a bit like hieroglyphics or something.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a form of kind of almost pictographic language, really.
Have we got from Latin and runes to the English we're speaking now and writing?
Well, it's a blend, isn't it? Because you've got the Anglo-Saxon English is English, as it were, and then you've got this blend of Latin coming in from Rome, and of course that comes up with the power of the church, bringing Latin in and the changes that comes along.
What about the Norman French?
So the Norman French, remember, the Norman French is brought in and spoken by the social elite after the Norman conquest, and we see that in our language today, where, for example, we've got all of the names of animals are in Anglo-Saxon today. So you've got a cow, you've got a pig, whereas in you've got the name of the food in high status in Norman French. So you have you then have beef, boeuf, and then you have pork. So the idea that the people who are looking after the animals are the poor, the farmers. You've got the people who are eating the food are the rich. And, of course, then you've got that difference in language. The rich only know this animal by its food name, and you've got the poor only knowing this animal by its actual living name as a pig or a cow.
By rearing it for the high status
people. By rearing it for the high status people. So even in language, you've got this idea of status and social control coming through.
We're just going off now to we've just been standing in this Saxon Hall house, and what we're going to now is see what the next stage up would have been in the fish house at Mere, which is actually one of the earliest houses of this sort of type that we've got, which gives you an idea of what it morphed into.
So we've just come through Mir. If you're ever driving through Mir, I suggest you stop and have a look off the main road, because you'll see it's a beautiful building, and we're set back next to the parish church. Behind the parish church, actually, it's further back from the road than the church, but it's a beautiful building, isn't it? What's the origin of this?
Well, this was a high-status building, originally probably built around the middle of the 1200s for the Abbot Michael of Amesbury. Was then altered and changed by Adam of Sodbury in the 1300s and Richard Beere in the 1500s.
So what was Mr. Amesbury doing in Glastonbury's patch then?
Well, again, this was one of his sort of escape holes. It was a bolt hole, like where we've been at Shapwick. But actually, he retired here, and it was such a good building that he came with a retinue of servants. He was given money, and a number of abbots retired here. And it's a beautiful, beautiful house, medieval style. You can see this chapel here would have been the abbot's private chapel, house going back. It's all been altered over the years.
Well, you can see some tremendous alterations, which you can actually read a lot of the history of a place like this through the way it's been altered, can't you?
And we're stood here on this finger of ground. Do you remember I said to you before about the three fingers of ground coming out in front of us, looking north from the church behind the manor house here we're standing by? You can see the Mendip going along in the distance. And then here we're on this little bit higher, well, not as high as the Mendip, but this bit of higher ground that slopes away very quickly down towards the marshes would have been sea. There would have been a big, big, big lake here, which was called, why it's called Mir. Mir after a mere. Mir is another word for a large pond or lake.
Mirror.
Well, mirror, yes, of course you'd see your reflection in it. And then behind us, going south, of course, is the next finger of highland, which is the Polden. So it's immaculately... Well placed, really, water transport.
Well, you can see this place, if you're ever in Mir, folks, by just coming into the churchyard of the parish church, how you get a really good look at it. But actually, it looks as if, to me, this was a chapel, and over the years, the big arch windows have been filled in. Maybe even that end window where the chimney now is has been filled in, and some smaller windows have been put in, maybe 1500, 1600, something like that. But it does look very old, this place.
It is very old. And what you've just been pointing out, that lovely arch there where the chimney's now gone in, that would have been the east window. And if we move round a little bit, you'll see even more.
Okay, so we're coming round the back. And this looks much more like, actually, that looks like a church hiding behind the back of this house.
Yes, it would be another ecclesiastical area. Would be very important, either a hall or a chapel, whichever they were back in those days. They've all been altered and changed over the years. But certainly, you can see the ecclesiastical windows in that.
So is this a private house now, or what?
Yes, it's a private manor owned by the farmer who we've just got the key off, his brother, and we've just spoken to his daughter in the car. They're very amiable people, and you pick the key up from knocking on the door or finding them on the farm, so that we have the key then to go to the fish house.
I've never seen a farmhouse like this before.
It is amazing, isn't it?
And I mean, that's the old sort of Gothic windows there in the farmhouse. That's now... Uses a farmhouse. Unbelievable, really, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the sort of gems that you, if you're just motoring along, you'd miss it. And you know, stop and have a look at it. Come and see how it just slopes down. And down here, you'd have had your boat. You see, you'd have come by boat, and we know from some of the archaeology here that there has been a harbour here, and this would have gone into the River Brew, which would have then given you access to the Axe, River Axe, going out at Axebridge, was altered by the medieval monks over a number of years, and it now exits through the Brew and comes out near Bridgewater. down there where the ammunition factory used to be, down on what's it called? The it's the one further over. The name will come back to me.
Luke, what clues have we got around us that can you see about what if we go, recycle back 500-600 years, what would have been going on here?
Well, very much at the time, this would have been, if we're going back 500-600 years to the time of the dissolution, we're talking about this being part of the estates of the abbey still. So we've been constantly talking about this idea of decentralised control within the lands of the abbey, and this would have been very much part of that. So Mark talked about it being used as a place of retirement for abbots. The idea that they're not just given this house to come and live in, they're given the land around it, like we talked about the almoner having land around the almoner's house. We talked about the abbot at Shapwick House having his land around that. The same here, this would have been an administrative centre for the land around to support the abbots in their retirement here, so to provide for them and provide them a comfortable life befitting their status or wants.
And does it help to be right next to what would have been a lake, massive lake? Well, and would you be able to get from here into the Bristol Channel?
Yes, absolutely. Well, we already talked about the water and water transport being so important. Basically, you can imagine getting onto a barge here, travelling down the river systems or down canal systems towards the Bristol Channel, from there transferring to an ocean-going vessel, and you could be within France, within a couple of days. And the idea is, if you got on that barge, you might have been able to get on, hypothetically, get on board at the bottom of your garden and then sail to France without setting foot on dry land. So it's this idea, you're on the international highways of the medieval world here. It's like kind of parking up a big house with really good motorway connections today. It's that sort of idea.
Yes, the River Brew would have come out of Glastonbury, where it was running mills and all sorts of other things, come down next door to the modern road that we've driven along from Glastonbury to Mere, and then come across where Mere Pools is, and then gone through a gap in the stone, through Pambrough, out to Axbridge. And originally, of course, big craft would have come in a fairly way up the River Axe from Bristol. There would have been a wharf, possibly at Pambrough or further down towards Axbridge, where they would have transferred supplies into barges, which were then brought up here, as we're looking on our left, and taken all the way up to Glastonbury Abbey to feed the hordes with the... well, there weren't many there, really. But to keep them in the status that they really thought they should deserve. Yes, well, as we're walking from the manor house, which was now we call the farm, we're walking east with the big lake or mere would have been on our left. All of that would have been water.
So this is the levels. It's now got cows and ditches. It's being properly drained. But at the time, it would have been sodden.
Well, it would have been quite a vast lake.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking of possibly a couple of square miles of water there. And where we stood right now here, there would have been pools. Because what is interesting is that the fish were not transported dead. Fish were transported alive, because fish go off very, very quickly. So the fish house that we're going to is not for curing fish or for dealing with fish. This high-status house is just for the chap who guards the fish.
Right, all where we're walking now, and this, you can see this place again. If you're looking, if you're driving east through Mere on the left-hand side, you'll see it. But the field we're walking across now is all lumpy and bumpy, isn't it? Really? Loads of them.
And well, you can see the down there, a ditch. So there would have been ponds here. So the big, vast area of lake out there, hence Mere, we've already said that, the fish would have been caught in there, transported here to the holding pools where we're standing, which would then, when demand arose, be put into big tanks and put on carts or into barges, because water transport would have been much easier and much better and more stable, because you know how bumpy it's been even in our cars today. So water would have been smoother, and this fish would have been taken to Glastonbury, or of course transported out to Bristol and to other places.
And of course Once you reach the abbey, you've got another pond there that would serve as the freshwater larder of fish there. So those live fish would be placed into the fish ponds at the abbey. And so you've got that supply chain to keep them well stocked with produce and...
So there was no fish going off, really. I mean, you know, there was no storage of the fish long enough for that to happen.
No, not really at all. And you've got to remember, fish is a massive staple part of the medieval diet for both the common people and of course, the monks. And so it
do
was
you think more so than today? I mean, most absolutely. People... I mean, if you go into a modern supermarket, well, there might be a fish counter, but there's much more meat sold,
yeah,
surely.
Fish very much was a much more commonly accessible food for everyone at that point. It's, of course, less... It's easier, in a sense, to farm fish or to catch fish than it is to dedicate large areas of land to animal husbandry. It's a lot easier. It's a lot more efficient.
Especially in this part of the world, because you've got a massive... Yeah. I mean, the levels is like a gigantic fish pond.
Absolutely. Really. You tap into your natural resources you've got in the area. That being said, though, a lot of the fish that would have been eaten by the more common folk on the Abbey's estates would have been saltwater fish from the sea. And that would have been shipped in, I believe I mentioned over from Uplime, areas around there in Devon, big area for supplying fish to the Abbey. And that fish would be either smoked or salted fish brought in at a much cheaper rate, and they'd be brought to markets in the local area and bought and sold at great quantities. The freshwater fish was always deemed a bit more of a higher expense. Some of the local population being this close proximity to the fishery certainly would have had more access to freshwater fish than their more inland compatriots would have done. But it does show you an idea that fish was very important.
Yeah, just going back to fish, you remember I was talking about the number of animals eaten in 1538. Just to pick up on the fish, I can just give you some figures for the fish. There were, for instance, 381 cod, 290 hake, 18 salmon, 497 white herrings, plus other things, just in 3 months eaten in the abbot's kitchen. I mean, that is, what, 1,000 fish, give or take?
But that's just for the abbot's kitchen.
Yes, yeah.
I mean...
Well, I know. Now you're beginning to get the idea of how the food consumption and the quality of the food was just fantastic.
So was he quite tubby, the abbot?
I don't know. I wasn't around to measure his tummy. But no, not all of them were. A lot of them worked actually quite hard. So and it wasn't, although some of the food was hot, very high in calories. I mean, fish isn't.
What about the abbot's kitchen? We talked about that last time I spoke to you. But I mean, how many people would have been being fed from there? It wasn't the main kitchen, was it?
No, I mean, from the convent's kitchen, which has all gone, depending on how many monks were there, would just have been feeding the monks, which would have been possibly 30, 40, some stages, perhaps 50 or even nudging 60. But that's all. Then the abbot's kitchen would have been feeding some of the important monks that he wanted to gather around, because it was all power positions, remember. Mm. It was who you were sat next door to, and that's the whole...
Life is still a bit like that, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so it was where you were placed on seated on the table, you know. If you were near where the abbot was sat, you know, this was obviously, you were important. If you were down the bottom of the table... well, you might as well not be there, but there you go. So, yes, it was so important guests, kings, you know, important nobles would have been here being fed.
Now, this fish house, I'm guessing, since all around us is these lumps where the ponds were, was being used to guard them, was it?
Yes, it's called a fish house, but actually it's for living in. It's not. It is not for processing fish. And what we're looking at here is the west end. You can see there was another building coming out here. The top would have been a garderobe, and the bottom would have been a store, and there would have probably been a detached kitchen here as well.
How can you tell that, then?
Because I've read the books.
And this is archaeology.
But actually, you can see, why have you got doorways coming out that just drop straight onto the land?
Okay, fair enough.
All right, but there you go. The front door is on the south side, which we're looking at. Now, if you look carefully, you can see two front doors, one downstairs and one upstairs.
Oh, is that a door? I thought it was a window up there.
Ah, you see, because the stairs have gone. There are no internal stairs. Okay. There would have been stone external stairs, and we're going in to look at this really chap who's just like just making sure no one stole the fish.
So this is actually accessible from the road here as well, isn't it? You can just walk from the road. I can see there's a gate and a stile just there.
But to get inside, you need to get the key
from the farmer.
From the farmer, who's very nice.
Just behind the church, if you're ever down here, folks.
There were previous buildings here, obviously from before the 1300s, but this is when it became a more high status thing. So as we've come inside, we can see the beautiful stonework. Behind us on the south side here is a lovely fireplace set into the south wall. And then as we turn round and look north, we can see some nice mullioned windows and a beautiful door to the east side. Two doors, in fact, leading into what would have been a parlour area or used for something like that. There would have been a floor, and the beam is right in front of us. And you can see that it's been burnt, because this roof used to be thatched, and there was a fire in here, and the whole thing was destroyed really in the 1800s, and then sort of put back together again.
Well, they put actually rather more than that. They've put a beautiful wooden roof on the top, proper roof on the top now, so it's pretty much permanently being looked after.
I mean, it's a stunning building. It's an example again of a high status or middle class status, relatively wealthy individual's abode or home. And of course, it really does. We're talking about showing the importance of fish here. Why would you bother spending the expense of providing one of your tenants with such a lovely building and an accommodation unless they had a particularly important role to play, or it was symbolic in the idea of how much importance you put on the resource they're guarding and having some involvement in administrating?
So this links on from the Saxon Hall House that we were looking at earlier on. This wasn't open to the roof. Now, in the Saxon Hall House that we saw, the Saxon Hall, was open to the roof. Here we have one of the best earliest examples in Britain of the next sort of development of British hall houses. And so you'd have this floor rather than being open up. You'd have got fireplaces and flues.
You've got a chimney, rather than just a big gap in the roof for the smoke.
And a smoky house. I mean, you imagine, you know, doing no smoking in those days. I don't know how they survived. But here, yes, you've got chimneys to take the smoke away. I mean, the whole comfort level is much improved with the stone, fewer drafts, nice windows, glazed rather than the wooden shutters. So, you know, just for a humble guy keeping an eye on the fish ponds.
But he can't have done it on his own, surely. There must have been other people, little eyes peeping out of the top windows.
I'm sure. But he would have employed staff. I mean, there would have been a huge number of staff looking after the fish.
The fish watchers.
as opposed to Crime Watch. But actually, the chap who lived here was on Crime Watch as well. And that's the important thing, because you can't get closer. Looking out through the window on the north side there, you can actually see the waters there.
I mean, do we know the extent to which the number of fish that would have been being processed through here? I mean, it must be quite a few. Do we know?
I don't think we know exactly.
Well, I mean, if we look at the figures for fish just for the Abbot's House for 3 months, 1,000 fish, give or take. When you look at the other things, so I mean, you're probably looking at thousands a month. Yeah. All right.
It's like quite a lot of buildings. I imagine after the dissolution, this might have just fallen into disrepair and maybe used as a barn or something like that.
Yes. Oh, it was. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, many of the abbey's buildings around the estates became kind of cultural buildings used for storage. Some of them, if they're chapels, converted to houses, various things like that. So yeah.
And of course, it's not just stone. What we've got is plastered. So the fish keeper here isn't just stuck in a stone barn. It's actually plastered. Again, we can't overemphasize enough the high status just for a fairly humble servant. Again, giving Glastonbury Abbey and its abbot the high status. Look, I can give my boot man or my fish man this sort of house, and no other abbot could really
stretched the resources to build something at this scale and this magnificence just for a humble fish watcher.
So would a job like this be, you know, sort of patronage? So it would be maybe changed quite frequently if someone else had decided, if you decide, right, I want to give someone, do someone a favour, they would make him the fish watcher?
Pretty much, could be, yeah. I mean, it's all about that who's in favour at the time. And of course, yeah, being awarded a job almost like this, many offices in the medieval world were kind of used as currency, in a sense, you know, kind of political currency for favours, kind of things like this. Certainly, if you've done a duty for the abbey, there's a good chance you might be rewarded with a certain office or a certain job that allowed you a certain income and various things like this. You taught yourself about the idea of land and importance and jobs almost being the economy of the time or the coinage of the time. It's very much is that here.
I imagine that, you know, if you're a starving peasant, I mean, crops have failed or whatever, that you'd be very tempted to come down here late at night and pinch a few fish.
Absolutely, yeah. And poaching was considered a serious crime in the medieval world. Because, of course, everything here, the fish, the deer, everything on the estates, the rabbits would have been considered to be owned by the landowner of the monastery. And, of course, so you're going and they would view it as in the same line as theft, arguably, in the medieval world.
Yeah, and there were constant, not physical battles, but legal battles with Wells Cathedral over fishing rights. And I mean, some actual physicality did break out in some of the villages between Glastonbury men and Wells men. So, I mean, we have sort of good evidence for that going on. So, yes, it's a really area of contention because of what it's worth.
Yeah, well, I mean, they used to set man traps, things like that. I don't know if the abbey ever did that. But, I mean, over the years, the idea of poaching has been potentially you could lose your life for it. And yet, maybe you're poaching to feed yourself because otherwise you'll starve to death. It doesn't sound like much of a life, really.
No, not really. I don't envy them.
No, I mean, but it was interesting how they treated their staff. If you got on well with the important people in the abbey, you had first choice of the best land. If something came up for renting, it was that. It's who you know, which things haven't changed today. It's not what you know always. It's who you know, and that was very much the case then. And going back to what we were talking about, people, was it inherited? Yes. So the fish keeper here, the person in charge of the laundry, of the cooks at Glastonbury Abbey, there were lots and lots of jobs that we know from the charters that they were inherited, and they were quite wealthy because they were paid. And of course, if it was Joe Bloggs who was the cook at Glastonbury Abbey, he wouldn't be the cook. He'd employ someone else of his family. He would just live on some of the income and then, you know, give a little bit to whoever it was who was, you know, doing the cooking. So these were sort of lifetime jobs, plum jobs. So lots of dosh with very little work.
Well, there's obviously the archaeology. You've just talked about charters. What other sources have you got to piece together what life was like, you know, sort of 500-600 years ago? Or even longer. Obviously, Glastonbury goes back much further than that, the Abbey.
Well, charters are very important. My colleague will pick up on this, I'm sure, in a moment, because we were the most sort of... things were recorded in intense detail. I mean, you look at it, absolutely in massive detail.
But surely with the Abbey, most of those records would have been destroyed.
Some of them have, but not all. So there is the great Glastonbury cartulary, which I'm looking at the moment, and gives all the way in which land and various things, gifts to the cook. So this is where I know the evidence from, that we can actually find these things. So it's in manuscripts, it's in other charters from other people. So it could be lords or other people who are having business with Glastonbury Abbey. My colleague's already spoken about how this was a sort of international business, and so that business would also be recorded by other people. So although some of our records may have gone, it's the records that they kept are still extant, still available.
Yeah, and you asked about kind of the archaeological evidence for how people lived. Basically, if we're talking about the medieval period rather than, say, the Anglo-Saxon era, so we're talking post-Norman conquest, we've got evidence in this area, of course, you know, numerous archaeological digs. Most common people on the Abbey estates would be living in timber-built houses. Towards the end of the Abbey's life, so we're talking towards the Tudor period, people are starting to live in stone dwellings. And basically, your average farming labourer would own maybe a couple of changes of clothes. He'd own some pieces of furniture, very basic, almost stick furniture, and they'd own some cooking vessels, pots and pans, and that would be it. When they passed away, some of those choicest bits might default to the landowner or his property owner, and some of them might continue on down to his family. We're talking about people who've got very little in terms of material wealth as we'd know of today. So we surround ourselves today with knickknacks, trinkets, interesting things. People in the past really didn't have that. Quite nicely, we're talking at Shapwick, that archaeologically, when looking at the villages there, we find things like Roman coins that have had little holes drilled in them to wear as necklaces by people. And these are found in a medieval context, not a Roman context. So the idea is you're a medieval villager who's found a Roman coin on the floor. You don't know what it is, but it's nice and maybe a copper alloy, it's shiny, and so you can drill a hole through it and wear it as a charm because you don't have any other jewellery. So this idea that the common folk are really kind of have a very different existence to people who would, for example, be running the abbot's fish house here or someone like a cook at the abbey. You know, we're talking very different social strata.
Maybe teach us something about modern consumerism.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're trying to always make you uncomfortable. Any advert is trying to make you feel uncomfortable with what you've got, so you'll shell out your money and buy what they're trying to tempt you with. Don't be tempted. But here we have. I think if we come back to the room here where we are, may we do that? Because if we just look at these very interesting two doorways,
yeah.
And if my colleague Luke goes up and stands there, he's going to have to duck down to get through, which I think shows us how people were slightly different. We don't know how this house was set up, but that was for some sort of utilities or possibly paperwork or doing whatever. We don't really
know. Yeah, it's just a partition at the end of the house there, isn't it?
It's a partition. But there wouldn't have been one up at the top. That would have been a big hall up at the top going right through here. So now if we go west through the door here on the ground floor, because the floor's missing, so we can't go through the top floor, but you can see the door above. So if we just come through here, past the fireplace, we can come in here and we can begin to see, actually, some of the plaster work and things that would have been in this here. So this end, possibly the parlour, with, again, the utility room you thought was a window, but actually you can see that actually it's a doorway.
So a parlour... We don't really have parlours anymore. We don't have enough spare rooms to have a parlour in our houses, do we?
No, but I mean, this is for preparing your food store, that sort of thing, whatever was going on. So it's all lumped into one room. You may have a utility room in your house today. You may have a kitchen. You may have all those sorts of things. This was all stuffed into here, really, a cooking outside. And you can see the corbels here. So upstairs, this would have been...
The corbels are there to support the upper floor, which is now gone.
Yeah, that's right. And you can see that if I stand here, you can see that actually it is quite a low wooden
yeah, there's floor. Maybe, well, about 8 inches or a stretch, maybe a foot clearance.
I'm 6 foot, so you can see.
Yeah.
So up above here...
They're definitely not wasting space, either that or they're very short.
That's right. Up here would have been the sleeping quarters, and out through the door up there, the garderobe. Now, the garderobe was very important, particularly in high-status houses, because you kept your clothes in the garderobe. Now, my colleague there is itching his beard and finding all sorts of lice and fleas, but he's not keeping his clothes in the garderobe. Do you know why you kept your clothes in the garderobe? Because the garderobe, if you remember, was just a wooden seat of which all the urine and everything else went down and just lay at the bottom. And so the fumes would come up, mostly ammonia. And you'd hang your clothes there because the ammonia would make sure that the lice and the fleas didn't like that
and so they would all go away from your furs and things, so you could put your clothes on without itching and scratching and finding nice little juicy morsels to nibble at.
Oh, lovely. But hang on, you would smell a bit as you walked around during the day, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes.
I think we've got this idea that everyone in the medieval world was a smelly peasant kind of idea. And I think that there's some truth to that in a sense. Certainly people didn't bathe as often as we do today. They certainly wouldn't have necessarily been unkempt, as we know. People did have a certain standard of personal appearance. But you've got to remember that the over-prevailing smell you'd have on you is that of smoke. If you've ever been around a fire for too long, your clothes really stink of it, your hair stinks of wood smoke, and wood smoke is a very powerful smell. And you're living in dwellings that are constantly, almost 24 hours a day, being heated by fires, or you're cooking on fires. So I think that most people's clothing and personalities, you know, not personalities, personal selves, would be completely inundated with that smell of smoke. And I think that would have been the overriding sense.
Might that actually keep the bugs off as well, do you think?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean,
but it's a good idea to stand next to the fire, get a sweater full of smoke just to keep the bugs away.
Yeah. And look, I'm standing here and I'm hoping mine's jumping onto you. Oh, really? So, okay. All right. So, so you can start scratching.
Okay, so you say there's an extension from here. What was that for? Where was it? And what evidence have you got for it?
Well, the archaeology has seen the foundation out there.
Plus, you've got the physical evidence, the fact there's two doors facing straight out into nowhere. One above leads out into the outside. Unfortunately, I think at some point they've modified the outside of the wall. It's quite likely that some of this structure was a lean-to structure. It means you would have been able to see where there were attachment points on the outside of the wall for those. Perhaps if we went outside, we might be able to see little traces of that still.
And what about whether a building like this, after it was been abandoned after the dissolution? I mean, some of these buildings were just simply cannibalised, weren't they, for other people to build? You know, you could build, if you managed to get enough stone from here, you can maybe even build yourself a side of a stone cottage or get yourself started.
But then why do that when you could live in this building? I think the idea is that certainly many monastery buildings were taken down. They tend to be buildings that were directly on monastery sites where the stonework is maybe partitioned off to use within a town and an urban setting. We often find in much more rural settings that monastic buildings or buildings on monastic estates are repurposed. So a lot of them are already dwellings, or they're already a small chapel that's easily convertible into a dwelling. They're not these great dormitories, great kitchens, great refectories, or a great church that's very hard to find a separate and distinct use for. So I think buildings like this largely survived. We don't have them today because, as with many old cottages and old buildings, over the intervening 500 years, they've eventually fallen into disrepair, become disused, and then been knocked down after that point.
I mean, we've been talking today a lot about the Abbey, although we've not been at the Abbey. Can you maybe say something about how the Abbey's used now? Because I know, for example, that you do allow groups in there to do sort of, even if it's some kind of worship out in the open sometimes, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly take a monthly communion service in St. Patrick's Chapel. And we do, we have other spiritual sessions for reflection and prayer and so on. And then there are lots of things. I mean, we're very eclectic, so, I mean, there are lots of other things going on.
I mean, we are as well, of course, a rather well-known tourist attraction in the area. We're a heritage site, of course, with the remains of this very large...
I hate to say it, you're a well-known tourist attraction all around the world.
We are, aren't we? Yeah, we're very lucky. But yeah, so people do visit from all over the world, from all walks of life and from everywhere. And we deal with people from the age of 2 till 90 and beyond. And we do various group visits, tours, talks, and try and make the place come to life a bit for
and
them.
You've got a bit of a museum as well.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, round the world. I mean, you think that we're on the Mappa Mundi from Hereford Cathedral. So, I mean, there's Glastonbury.
Crikey, when's that dated? Do you know?
Mappa Mundi is 13th century. All right,
so you're on the map.
It'd be 1200. So we're on the map, very near Jerusalem and everything else. I mean, their geography was hopeless. But the extent of Glastonbury's influence around the world, I mean, there's Glastonbury Abbey in the USA. In fact, there are a number of places called Glastonbury in the USA. So it's just interesting. One of our early monks here was Bishop of Norway. And so you can see that the whole thing is not just about Glastonbury, it's not just about England. We had sites in Ireland, we had sites in Wales, we had obviously people, other monks working in abbeys round Europe. So, I mean, it is an international business from that point of view. It has an international influence even today.
Just tell us a bit about what people can expect if they come down to the Abbey for the day.
Sure. Well, if you come to the Abbey, you'll come in. We've got a wonderful museum showing artefacts and telling you a bit of the story of the Abbey. And then we've outside got the ruins of the once monastery, situated in about 36 acres of parkland.
Hang on, hang on. What's the difference between a monastery and an abbey?
An abbey is a type of monastery. So basically, an abbey is a monastery. They are one and the same thing. A monastery is a catch-all term for a type of ecclesiastical buildings. So it's usually a convent where you'd have monks or nuns living in seclusion. There are different types. Okay, so there's abbeys, priories.
The abbey is like the church of the monastery, is that?
No, Abbey is a monastery. I think it's very hard. It's kind of one of these arbitrary definitions.
All right. It has the Abbey Church. So there's the Abbey, which is the, if you like, an overarching term, like monastery. So it gets very confusing. So
it's longer than a lot of cathedrals, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, 177
metres, 580 feet in length. Yeah, so it's a massive building. Certainly would have been one of the largest churches in medieval Europe at the time. So
you're doing these services every month in one of the chapels in the Abbey. Are you sort of competing with the parish church then?
No. It's all organised through. We work collectively, and that's very important, really. I mean, Christian churches ought to act collectively because we have a care for people. And therefore, even if they're running something differently to us, we still need to have a care for them. So, yes, we work very closely with David McGeoch, who's the rector at Glastonbury, who's one of our trustees. And so, yes, a very close relationship. I just sort of, when you come on your tour around Glastonbury, what's fun is using your eyes to look at stone walls. Because we're stood in the Abbot's fish house here, and we're looking at the north wall in the parlour, and just by using our eyes, we can actually see some of the development, and I just find it fun. You needn't be a historian, you needn't be an architect, you just need to
hang
use
on,
your
that
eyes.
Looks like it used to be a doorway.
Yes, well done, Mr. Tony Gosling. All right, absolutely. And that's what's fun. Use your eyes to interpret it, and you begin to tell the story for yourself. You won't necessarily know when that happened, but yes, there was a doorway there. And if you go back and look at the English Heritage information, you'll see that they've put a doorway in there at a certain period.
Now, you've talked about a lot to do with this fish house, but you haven't shown me where the people who were caught trying to steal the fish were locked up.
Ah, right. We don't know. That is a very interesting point. We know it at the Bishop's Palace in Wells. There's a lock-up. So if you visit the Bishop of Wells's palace, do go in there, just inside. You can get free entry into the beginning of it. And round to the right, as you come across the drawbridge into the gate, there's the bishop's lock-up there. That's worth looking at just underneath. We know that Glastonbury Abbey had prison cells, but that was just for the monks, we believe. I don't have evidence that it was used for anyone else.
Well, so the monks were some of the naughtiest people in Glastonbury, is that true?
Well, yes, they can be. And that would be another programme where we could look at it. And I'm afraid it's the normal things, sex and money and that sort of thing. We had no drugs in those days, so that was made it a bit simpler. But, I mean, things like monks were not to have, so I can read in some of the documents, monks were not to have their own laundress. Now, if you read, they must use the one person for the monastery who does the laundry. Now, why were monks having their own laundress? I'll leave that to your imagination.
We were talking about it a second ago, the idea about the common people not having a lot. And Mark touched upon the idea today that we're very much driven by consumerism, and the fact that these people existed for hundreds of years. They may not have been necessarily happy or free in the sense that we'd know today in some ways, but they certainly live a much more humbler life, and they still got married, had fun, had festivals, had good times, and that's all within their settings. But they did that without the need for all of our modern trappings and accoutrements, and I think there's something rather nice to learn from that anyway.
The other thing, Mark, is that many of them would not even have left their own village, maybe gone to the next village, but they certainly weren't anywhere near as they weren't going on budget airlines or anything like that.
Absolutely. Well, when I was vicar in Suffolk back in the 1990s, in the villages, I had four village churches and would move around some of the villages to help out. I found people who had never been out of their village, even in the 1990s, who perhaps might have gone to Ipswich once, but never been anywhere else.
And they didn't like it.
And they didn't like it, absolutely. it's still today.
I suppose in that sense as well, you can look at it as well, and on the flip side, look at how lucky we are in modern life, where we get to travel, visit other places, have these experiences that for hundreds of years were locked away to people, and we can see other places, visit other cultures.
Yes. Come and visit. I mean, that, get in your car and then get out of your car. I mean, that's the thing, because it's a whole intriguing, exciting environment out there to explore. People just talk to people in the street. That's what I do. You ask a question and most people are very willing to answer, and you're learning. There's such an exciting world out there. Come and enjoy it. Come and see Glastonbury. Come and see the Fish House. Come and see Shapwick. Come and see whatever it is.
Well, it is actually geared up for people to come down, isn't it? The visitor centre we were at earlier. There's also a lot of space for people to just go walking. It's very peaceful, quiet, and bird watching.
Yes.
You know, where else are you going to see a marsh harrier?
Yes. Yeah, bird watching. Just in my garden, I see sparrowhawks sort of coming in, and it's just amazing. So, yeah, there's lots to do, lots to see, lots to be involved with, lots to eat, lovely cider to drink, don't forget that. That goes back some time too. So come and do what our ancestors used to do. Have a good time.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And we also have a podcast available of the whole of our Glastonbury Abbey Sphere of Influence programme, which is about an hour and 45 minutes long altogether. You've just heard part two. You can suggest interviews and subscribe to our email list if you like, and listen the week before broadcast at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. So, thanks to our guests, Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder, for the Glastonbury Abbey Sphere of Influence programme. It follows on from last year's show, broadcast in August 2018, 1,300 Years of Glastonbury Abbey. And that was from the Abbey itself. Very different to this, which is looking at some of the various buildings around Glastonbury, which the Abbey controlled. Thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. So, thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. inshallah. Meanwhile, until next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now. We'll be right back.
Yeah.